This episode of the Robot Report podcast is sponsored by RE Squared Robotics. RE Squared Sapient Intelligent Robotic Arms are designed to improve worker safety and productivity using core technology originally developed by RE Squared Robotics for the U.S. military. RE Squared Sapient systems feature intuitive human-robot control interfaces, outdoor computer vision, and autonomy capabilities. RE Squared Sapien delivers value across a spectrum of outdoor industries, from improving worker safety during aircraft inspections for the aviation industry, to eliminating the hazard of working at height for the construction industry, to keeping workers safe from high voltage hazards for the energy market. To learn more, visit resquared.com/RE2Sapien. That's resquared.com/RE2Sapien. This episode of the Robot Report podcast is brought to you by Futek Advanced Sensor Technology. Futek helps leading innovators shape the future by providing custom sensing and test measurement instruments for groundbreaking applications. Futek solutions push the limits of measurement capabilities and development to reinvent and redefine sensor technology. To learn more, visit Futek.com. Welcome to episode 41 of the Robot Report podcast, which brings conversations with robotics and innovators straight to you. I'm Steve Crow, editorial director of the Robot Report. Thanks, as always, folks, for tuning in. You can find us on Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, SoundCloud, Spotify, anywhere you get your podcasts. Please subscribe, leave us a rating, give us a review. Joined now by Mike Oitzman, editor of the Robotics Group here. Mike, jam-packed show today. We'll hear from Ambi Robotics' Ken Goldberg and Jim Leifer, and Carbon Robotics CEO and founder Paul Meixel in a bit. But up first, Mike, some major, major news to announce before we get into things, and probably the worst kept secret in the world out there. But you know what? Maybe should we hold off again? Should we delay it even more?
No, yeah. Please.
All right. Not only did we hire you as editor of the Robotics Group, also acquired the Mobile Robot Guide, and we'll be adding it to our robotics portfolio here at WTWH Media. So I want to say, you know, congrats to you. I've known you for a long time, so kudos. Must be a great feeling to, you know, finally have the cat out of the bag. You've built a tremendous media brand over there, and really looking forward to officially onboarding the product here. Still a ton of work to do, obviously, but super happy for you. Congrats, man.
Yeah, thanks, Steve. And it's exciting to be a part of the WTWH Media family and join you and Dan and everyone else on the team. I'm really looking forward to extending the site and growing everything going forward. And you know, it's been super fun up to this point, and I'm just excited to see what's going to happen next, and you know, with the resources that WTWH brings to the table.
Yeah, so we sent out the official announcement earlier this week. So folks who maybe didn't see that announcement or are new to Mobile Robot Guide, you can go to mobilerobotguide.com to check out what we'll be doing over there as time goes on. Obviously, Mike, you've been in around mobile robotics for some time now. Just what excites you about the space right now? And again, tell those who might not be familiar with Mobile Robot Guide, the genesis of the site, and what they can expect from that site going forward.
Well, thanks, Steve. Yeah, you know, it started as a passion project. When I left Adept Omron after the acquisition 5 years ago, after running the product management team for a couple of years, you know, I still had that passion and excitement for mobile robots. But again, it was the opportunity to, step outside of the vendor's view of the market and really look at the market as a whole. And, I had a ton of knowledge about the market at that point. And it's been fun to just sit here and watch the market grow. And, you know, right now, warehouse automation, I think, is the hot market for mobile robots. And there's a ton of solutions. There's a ton of opportunity. Every company and every individual that I talk to that's in warehouse automation can't ship enough product right now. So the demand is just through the roof. You know, and hey, the other thing that's been fun this last year has been the innovation around UV disinfection. Mobile Robot Guide was the first publication to cover that application. And at last count, I think there's more than 80 solutions on the market. 80 mobile robot solutions. Now, I don't think they're all going to survive.
No, probably not.
But there's a few market leaders out there like UVD Robots who were in this before the pandemic hit. And, you know, our focus has always been on the buyers. Trying to educate buyers, as I said, you know, when I was a technology leader on the sell side, it was all about trying to educate people about the application and the technology before they would consider buying. So, you know, I think that that was my mission from the beginning. And, you know, now we want to continue to extend that same information to other readers as well. So, you know, the other thing that I've done is was focusing primarily on autonomous mobile robots from the beginning. That was more than enough for one person, but you know, there was that market we all know about, which was, you know, automatic guided vehicles or AGVs, which have been around for decades. We're going to extend coverage now to also cover those solutions and also things like, you know, autonomous fork trucks. There's been a ton of innovation in the last 10 years around that. And then, of course, there's a lot of adjacent automation solutions, which maybe aren't technically autonomous mobile robots, but automated storage and retrieval systems, right? So that's a big market. And I went into detail in this in the fall buyer's guide in, for warehouse solutions, where I define, you know, what is an ARS, SRS system, what's an AMR, what's an AGV, and, you know, covered all of the solutions around warehouse robotics. And I'm hopeful that we'll be able to continue those types of publications here as part of WTWH, again, as an aid to, you know, educating buyers. So again, I hope that our listeners are find the information interesting. And again, if there's something that you want to hear or read about or want us to talk about, you know, please reach out and let me know what your thoughts are and what you would like us to cover.
Yeah, I think it's a great fit for what we're trying to do here in our overall portfolio. You know, we sort of have the key stakeholders in the robotics community itself, the engineers, developers, integrators, distributors covered with the Robot Report, with Robotics Business Review. And we have a couple of nice end user plays now with collaborative robotics trends and obviously mobile robot guide. So to the listeners of this podcast, who probably are primarily comprised of, you know, folks developing, selling, installing different types of mobile robotics systems, Mike and I and Dan, we have a ton of ideas as to things that we want to have done on Mobile Robot Guide to continue to bring it to the next level. But we're looking for your input. So if there are ideas or things that you can contribute, content ideas to help educate potential buyers of your solutions, please reach out to Mike or myself. Our emails will be on in the show notes here, and would love to get your involvement. But again, congrats to you, my friend. I've known you for quite some time. You've done a tremendous job already. So, you know, happy to finally spread the news. And again, folks, you can check out Mobile Robot Guide at mobilerobotguide.com. One quick note before we get into things here, nominations for the RBR 50 Innovation Awards actually closed today. We're recording this on Friday, April 16th. So the awards closed today. If you don't know about the RBR 50, it's our annual innovation awards program. It's been around for about a decade now. Again, some of the companies on the list last year, Agility Robotics, Boston Dynamics, Waymo, I think Universal Robots has been on the list virtually every year. So you get the idea of the kind of companies that we're looking for. Our editorial team, we select the winners. There's no cost to enter, which is a great part of the program. So if you think your company belongs on the 2021 list, or we've had people nominate other companies that have done innovative work, head over to our sister publication, Robotics Business Review. It's roboticsbusinessreview.com today. Again, the final day to enter the program, Friday, April 16th, for your chance to be part of the 2021 RBR 50 Innovation Awards. Up first, Mike, our interview with the great Ken Goldberg and Jim Leifer of Ambi Robotics. Company was formerly known as Ambidextrous Laboratories, recently changed its name when it emerged from stealth mode at the end of March. They've released a couple of products that perform a variety of pick and place operations for e-commerce and logistics applications. Always great to talk with Ken. I know you've known him for quite some time now. Just tell us, what did you take away from the discussion?
Ken's enthusiasm and commitment to this problem is noteworthy. Ken is a dynamic speaker and always an entertaining keynote speaker for anyone who's seen him on stage at any live event in the past, or if you have a chance to hear him speak in the future, as you'll hear. It's always a great and entertaining opportunity. You know, I've known Ken for 3 decades now since I was a part of the Adept applications group, and we helped them program the robot garden 30 years ago, one of the first robots to be put on the web, a very interesting application. Ken has been a part of this concept of trying to figure out how to help robots figure out, you know, how to pick up things without ever seeing them before. And, you know, that's really what AMBI's all about.
Yeah. Talk about another, I don't want to say, I know they said they came out of stealth mode, but I think as I wrote in the piece, really not a secret as to what they were doing, right? He talked a lot about how this is kind of his career's work, right, coming to fruition here. So he's been focused on robotic grasping for some time. A lot of the work here is based off DexNet, the grasping database that was created by Ken's team at UC Berkeley. It was interesting to hear that that's no longer an open source solution that others can take advantage of. Why would they keep it that way, right? I mean, this is sort of the secret sauce to what AMBI Robotics is trying to do. So some great stories that he shared. Ken shared a great story about a demo the team did for Amazon a few years ago that really sparked their interest in commercializing this technology. There's also a Revenge of the Nerds angle to all this that Ken gets into towards the end of the discussion. So again, always great to talk with him. So here's our conversation with Ken Goldberg and Jim Leifer of AMBI Robotics. Enjoy. One of the big stories recently, Mike, AMBI Robotics exiting stealth mode, formerly known as Ambidextrous Robotics. The company raised $6.1 million in seed funding at the end of March for its picking robots and its operating system that are based on sim-to-real artificial intelligence. And here to give us the lowdown on the development of those systems and the company are co-founder Ken Goldberg and CEO Jim Leifer. Leifer just named the CEO, previously headed up Kindred AI, which is quite interesting. Last fall, acquired by Ocado for a cool $262 million. He also has more than 2 decades of logistics-related experience at Walmart.com, One Kings Lane, and UPS. Gentlemen, congrats on the launch, and thanks for finding the time to fit us in. How are things going?
Thank you, Steve. Appreciate it.
Yeah, fantastic, Steve. Thank you for having us today.
Yeah, no, anytime. Ken, let's start with you. I know this a lot of what's going on at AMBI Robotics is based on DexNet, and we'll get into that, the role that it's playing in a few minutes here. But just for folks who are listening and may have missed the news, tell us about the genesis behind AMBI Robotics and what it is that you guys are trying to do.
Well, we started working on this. I like to say I've been working on the same problem for 35 years. Since I was an undergrad. We have been looking at the idea of how do we grasp objects, and in particular objects of differing shapes and sizes, because it's fairly easy to grasp a cube or a cylinder. But once you get into more complicated shapes, the problem is very difficult. And in fact, it's challenging because humans are very good at this. Humans, you know, even at a young age, baby, you can hand it almost any shaped object and it will pick it up, no problem. But robots really have a problem. They're still klutzes, basically. And so we've been working on trying to tackle this from a variety of perspectives. One of the big breakthroughs came when Jeff Mahler, the co-founder of AMBI, joined my lab, and we started working together to apply deep learning to the problem. And we combined ideas from analytic models that go back over 100 years to being able to understand the physics and the mechanics of grasping with deep learning to be able to address the perception aspect of it. And we also combined it with 3D sensing, with depth sensors, and then trained a very big neural network on lots of examples in simulation. And that was a big differentiator, because there was the we had seen the success of the system called ImageNet, which was trained on lots of labeled images for learning how to recognize objects in a scene. And so we tried to apply it. Our idea was to apply the analogous idea to grasping. Mm-hmm. And in this case, we wanted to generate a big, very large data set of grasps, and in particular, robust grasps. And so we started collecting objects on the internet, and then applying algorithms to find robust grasps, and then using those as training examples. And then the results started working surprisingly well. We were just, you know, we didn't expect that it was going to generalize that well to new objects in real physical environments. And that got us very excited. And that's what led to the founding of the company.
Wow. Yeah. And well, Ken, I think you've got a deep set of experience in figuring this all out. And as you said, it's taken you years of research to get to where you are. But I want to bring Jim into the conversation as we're sort of talking about where the company is looking to go. And so, Jim, as you know, there's a lot of companies using robot manipulation to help supply chain with operators solve some of their challenges. How do you think Ambi is going to differentiate itself from these other competitors?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think of it this way, you know, anyone can buy robotic hardware and build it out. The AI technology that Ken was just talking about truly sets us apart from our competitors. Mm-hmm. And with that integration into the DexNet simulation to reality platform, we're able to handle this amazingly wide variety of objects. And like Ken said, I too have been trying to solve the same problem for a very long time, maybe not 35 years, but in the realm of fulfillment centers, trying to figure out how exactly do we optimize those, create better throughput, reduce the load on the human side doing these repetitive tasks. So that is definitely the way that I think about differentiating us. And the other is that we're very customer centric at Ambi, and we understand the customer's problem. We're right there with them. And we do the things, I think of it this way too. It's like, we will do the things that others will not. And that might be, you know, staying up all night to meet some code release for the customer, or being on site for days or weeks if we need to, or whatever it is, mm-hmm. to walk through those walls of fire with the customer. Mm-hmm.
So why launch now? How's the solution matured to the point that you guys believe it's ready to commercialize? And is the market, you think, ready for your solution at this point?
Well, there's two parts to that. Now, I think Jim is perfectly poised to answer the second one. In fact, he could probably answer both of them. But what I will say is that the technology side, which is where I'm focused, and I have to say, we've been so delighted to have Jim on board, because he understands the business so well at all levels, and you know, he really brings that deep, thorough expertise that's really needed to be very customer focused, which we are. Mm-hmm. And what we've done is we say we underpromise and overdeliver. We really like to keep the predictions under control. We are very careful not to make exaggerated claims about the system. And it's really important to note that any system is going to have certain failure modes, that it's not going to work 100% of the time. One thing that's really nice about this business is when you fail, you know, it's unlike self-driving cars. If you fail there, it's really bad. In our case, the worst thing that happens is you drop a package, and that's not the end of the world. So that happens occasionally. But what we've been doing is really spending time since Jeff moved to start the company with other co-founders, also from the lab, who are amazingly strong engineers. They're just incredibly talented, very, very methodical and skilled at basically identifying what was needed and how to innovate in just the right way to be able to put together a system that could combine the innovations with practicality and something that would work consistently over time. So that's taken a couple of years. We had to basically learn what customers wanted, and then learn how to tailor a system that would absolutely deliver that. And it's involved learning about new sensors, new actuators, new and and new software that would basically put all this together in a very reliable combination and then test it with real customers. And that's what got us to the point now where we feel we're ready to really go to the market.
You touched on something there, Ken, that we wanted to ask you about, basically human in the loop, right? So how much autonomy, how much success, what's the success rate and how much, the requirement for human in the loop assistance, how much of that do you foresee as you guys get started here?
Well, it's a great question because, first of all, I want to say that we're not eliminating warehouse workers. There are so many jobs out there, and workers are going to be needed. We're going to need. Warehouses cannot fill the demand for labor that's needed today and into the future. The demand has just skyrocketed. So there is a lot of cooperation, but the nice thing about this system is that once it's in place, it can operate autonomously. So workers basically come in with bins of objects, packages, and then move those bins around. And occasionally, if something goes wrong, they can unstick the system. But generally, it can do the sorting problem, which involves the following three steps. It has to pick up an object from a bin, and these objects can be all kinds of different shapes and sizes, right? They're anything that can be shipped. So it can be loose bags and all kinds of weirdly packed things in bubble wrap, et cetera. It has to pick that object up, then scan it, find its barcode, which is non-trivial. Mm-hmm. And then three, get it into the right bin for further processing. So there may be 20 or 30 bins out there and has to basically get that object and put it in the right bin. So that three-step process is called sorting. And that is the objective that we were given was do that without human intervention. And that's what the new system does.
So Jim, how about some lessons that you've learned from your Kindred AI days about deploying systems like this at customers?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a few parts that I want to touch on as I answer your question. First of all, going back to Ken talking about me being here, I have to say, yeah, I'm absolutely honored to be here with these guys. And Ken and the other founders, Jeff and Steve and David and Matt, everyone is so incredibly focused on their part that they play. And that is what has allowed the technology to go forward so quickly and get these solutions into production. It's really a huge honor to be here. So that's number one. Number two, you asked about the customer being ready for AI robotics in the world. And mm-hmm. there's been this intersect point that on one side, there's the customer, the retailer, the parcel transportation company, who can't find enough people to deal with all of the individual bits and pieces, right? So at the each's level, whether that's products or parcels or boxes or whatever it is. So that makes part of the solution come into play. The other is that the commodities that make up the solution, the robot, the electronic equipment, the lighting, and all of those kind of commodity parts of it have come down tremendously in price and make it an affordable option. And then the third is that with things like DexNet, the AI has truly evolved to a point that it's already. So absolutely, this is the answer to a problem that's been really hard to solve for our customer, the retailer and the parcel transportation company. The other part is things that I learned from the Kindred days, and you touched on this part of it too, is there are other solutions out there that will require that the algorithm have some human assistance from time to time, right? Some supervised learning that goes on and helping the robot in the middle of the task that it's trying to perform with the algorithm behind it. The Ambi technology is actually not like that. So what I have seen is that we have a very high percentage of being able to grasp accurately. So we don't need a human in the loop from that standpoint to assist the AI whatsoever. And the other part of this is that in having that ability, you don't have to have like heavy data bandwidth in place and those kinds of things when you do the implementation, which other systems have needed. So that enables us to go into locations that are in different parts of the country that may not have, the kind of, we live here in the Bay Area, so data is, dripping all over the place. So those are the kinds of things that I learned. And then there's one other is that the grasp, what I call the grasp profile, the product profile, is so broad at Ambi the ability to pick up rigid items and soft deformable items and everything in between makes this solution actually deployable, and it works on the first day.
And Ken, that's really the key, right? Is being able to handle that variety of objects. I'm sure you saw, not trying to derail the conversation, but I'm sure you guys saw the new solution from Boston Dynamics, their stretch prototype. And some of the videos that they released really showed it handling one type and one size of box. And I'm sure they'll improve that, the capabilities to handle different items going forward. But that's really the key here, right, Ken, is the variety of objects and sizes and weights that you guys are able to deal with.
That's correct, Steve. So that is the difference between what we call just grasping and universal grasping, where you can really figure out a way to grasp very odd shaped objects. In fact, we spent a lot of time in Jeff's PhD dissertation looking at adversarial objects. These were very strange things like that were super action figures and stuff like that, stuffed animals, all kinds of things that were old shoe.
Did you bring it to your house? Did you have this operating in your house, just finding random objects? No.
We brought them from our house to the lab. We had essentially, our lab looks like an old garage sale, actually, yeah. Because we have literally, we still have in there thousands of objects that we would throw at this thing. And we would, just try to make it fail. In fact, we would have visitors come to the lab, and it was kind of a challenge. Give it something it can't grasp. And it, the joke was people would throw their car keys in, and I'd say, listen, if it picks it up, we get to keep the car. And it would always pick it up. In fact, it would be able to clear bins just completely empty, right? It would just pick everything out of the bin routinely. And we would let people dump things in. And so we're very proud of that aspect of it, Steve. That's really the secret sauce, if you will. I think that we understood the mechanics based on, as I mentioned, 100 years of really solid science and understanding the friction, center of mass, the geometry of objects, the errors that are inherent in sensing, control, and physics itself, because it's very hard to model frictional interactions. And one small error, even a millimeter error, can actually make the difference between dropping the object and picking it up successfully. So that sweating those details was a very crucial part of this work. And as Jim said, the team, including Steve, David, and Matt, have worked with Jeff to basically take that and then build it out into a system that involves the mechanical elements, in this case, a gantry robot, that can then take those lifted packages. Oh, I should mention, and scanning was another problem we had not considered. But it turns out that we could apply similar techniques to being able to learn from simulation to the problem of finding barcodes.
So tell me, Ken, what happens going forward with DexNet? I mean, you touched upon it a little bit, the role that it's playing in the AmbiOS. I believe DexNet is open source, right? But it seems like that's playing a big role in the secret sauce that you guys have. What happens with DexNet going forward? Does that stay open source? Are you guys going to continue to update that going forward?
Oh, great. Thank you for asking that. Let me clarify sure. that. So it's yes and no. So DexNet, we did share a fair amount of the code there and the data sets because it was really important for publications. But as soon as we left the Berkeley, and Berkeley holds a license to the IP of that, which we have an exclusive license to IP.
Got it.
But as soon as we left, we rebuilt the system from scratch. And we made it much more industrial strength. We built in all kinds of new elements to it. So that is now proprietary. And that's what runs all of the systems that we're using today.
Interesting. So it totally makes sense as you bring technology out of the lab into commercial use, that's your model. So Ken, tell us a little bit more. I think I'm really interested to learn more. You're calling the new software AmbiOS, and how are you able to close the reality gap, I guess you would call it, between simulation and reality, and how much of the new system involves, working in simulation to train the system before it actually deploys to a real work cell with real product?
So the simulation is another very important part. That is essential because there are other groups that are using deep learning, but using lots of physical trials. Mm-hmm. Our idea was to avoid that by doing lots of these trials in simulation. And essentially, you're exactly right. The crucial question is you might learn something in simulation, but it doesn't transfer the sim to real problem. Mm-hmm. So to address that, we have developed the idea of using stochastic uncertainty, and we inject noise into the simulation. Now, it's different than what's called domain randomization, which some other groups are using now. But what we do is we inject very, very specific noise that's very highly tuned to the real sensor, the real robot, and the real range of packages that we're encountering. Mm-hmm. So that's actually a crucial part of our IP, which is how we do that in a way that matches the real conditions the robot's going to encounter when it executes. And so if we change the gripper or the sensor or the robot or the packages, then you essentially have to retrain your software. Mm-hmm. But that can take, again, weeks or months if you're doing it in physical experiments, or years. But in our case, we can do it in simulation. So if you change the gripper, we rerun the simulation overnight and retrain a new neural network to run the next day.
Explain it to me in layman's terms. I mean, why isn't it a problem for you guys? I mean, that's all that I've heard in the decade of me covering the robotics industry is, you know, the sim to real problem is a real problem. You seem to be saying the opposite of that.
Well, no, I'm not saying Steve, I will say it is a real problem. And in so much of research, it's the headline banner problem right now in robotics, which is going from sim to real. And that's true for self-driving cars. That's true for walking machines. That's true for anything that you want to do, UAVs, anything. We can simulate, but the simulation is always imperfect. So how do you transfer that into reality? That is a big problem, and I'm not claiming we've solved it. But what we do is we inject for this problem, for grasping, we inject noise at just the right levels. And I can go into more detail, but I think we'll get I'll go down that rabbit hole. But
we only have an hour, Ken.
I know. I'm sorry. Okay. I get so excited about this because, again, this problem I've been, you know, struggling with for years. And that's why when we saw this breakthroughs, I was so surprised and excited. So one thing I will say is that it's a matter of being able to fine tune the noise that you're injecting into the simulation, mm-hmm. and then being able to rerun these simulations very fast. That's the key idea, that you can do that in, you know, overnight, and then you have a new system ready to run the next day.
Got it. Jim, did you have something that you wanted to add to
that? I just say, you know, from an implementation perspective and solving this bigger problem for the customer, there's almost endless permutations to the objects that are out there, right? So the way that I think of it is when you implement the solution, whether you learn more from being in the physical world, as many do, and like getting more examples and feeding those to the algorithm, or in the sim world, as we do, you know, the way I see this is the expectation from the customer is that the solution be able to handle some large portion of the problem. And we, all of us, when I say we, like all of us and the competition and everyone, they're solving this very big problem from all kinds of different aspects. And as others do well, we also do well. So just, I want to tie back in Boston Dynamics announcement. Their good news is good news for us. This is, like I said, it's a big problem and there's lots of solutions to be provided. And I think there'll be, you'll see more and more news coming out from others as we're approaching the ProMat conference and other things that are going to be coming up this year. So all of that good news is just good news for us as well. And I'm happy for everyone out there in the industry.
We're seeing that across the board, you know, that a lot of this research in and implementation now of AI-based algorithms is finding its way to, you know, to commercial applications. And you guys are just one more excellent example of how that's now reached the point in time that it's feasible to make it work in real world situations. But I think, Jim, as again, coming back to your role in the organization going forward, and you know, you played a pivotal role in scaling Kindred to the point from a startup to the point that it was acquired for you know, a large amount of money. What do you think are the keys now to scaling Ambi robotics going forward in a similar?
Yeah. So we have the foundational items, right? We have the technology. We have an amazing team, as we've been saying, and we've been bringing on other amazing people into the organization as we scale this quickly. The unlocks are the manufacturing side. So there's all these components to it. Manufacture the solution, get it out there into the customer's hands, meet the peak holiday demand that's, you know, it's pressing on us now. When I was at Walmart, we always talked about when the next peak is, and the next, you'd start doing work for the next peak like 2 days after Christmas and the New Year's kind of holidays happen. So for us, the name of the game is getting these solutions built now, getting them into the customer's hands, and then supporting the customer. So it's definitely a rocket ship is definitely launched.
And you've built out your sales channel now, and beginning to build out your partner channel.
Yeah. Good question. So on the sales front, we are, we have a lot of work to do for the number of customers that are already in the door. And as you can imagine, the news that's happening and coming out of stealth and all of those things, there are certainly more customers lining up to talk to us about what the solution can do for them. And we'll bring those in. In order of priority, we must and we will take care of the customers that we had firstly and make sure that they're taken care of. It's been great so far, and we'll expand in terms of the taking care of those customers. We'll expand the manufacturing pipeline as much as we need to. Like last part, I would say when I talked earlier on about being customer centric organization, it's important to me that we don't get over our skis in terms of being able to support, right? I wouldn't want us to be in a position where we're deploying so many of these robots that we're not able to support that customer. So we'll make sure that we balance that.
Can you tell us anything about some of your early customers or the early partners that you're working with?
We can soon. We are not disclosing those yet, but we would be able to very soon. And I wanted to say something about that, which is in interacting with those undisclosed customers, I am confident that they, it's always better to have someone else talk about your success than you do. So right. I would just say here that when we can talk about those customers, I think they'll have lots of great things to say about Ambi Robotics.
What can you tell us about the business model, Jim? Are you selling them just outright? Is there a robotics as a service model in play here?
Yeah. Great question. We really like the robots as a service model. I've used that before, as you probably know, and we're embracing that. And we've talked to our customers about that. I believe it's the right thing to do for the customer because it lowers the barrier to entry for them. They don't have to lay out capital in ways that makes it hard for their approval process and all of that. So yes, it's robots as a service. At the same time, if there is a customer that wants to talk to us about the hardware sale kind of model, we're not opposed to that. But again, customer centric, we want to make sure that we take care of the customer, but most of it will be robots as a service.
Cool. Ken, I want to ask you this one. And again, I'm not sure how much you're going to be able to say about this one, but your co-founder, Jeff, he had previously told us the DexNet team began considering commercializing its technology around, I think it was the 2017 timeframe after the DexNet 2.0 release. And then in 2018, you guys were invited by Amazon to give a demo of the technology. Obviously, Amazon, e-commerce leader, in search of a way to automate the picking aspect of its operations. What can you tell us about that demo? You know, any feedback that they gave your team and sort of how that really maybe inspired you guys to continue with the idea of commercializing this technology, you know, fast forward a few years and here you are.
I will answer that. I have to be a little bit cagey, but we were invited to a private event to demonstrate the system, and we brought along several hundred objects of various shapes and sizes, as I mentioned, and we basically set up a table with all this, and we the CEO of that company, who's you can you you and you know his name. He he came in and it was we just had this incredible session. It lasted about 20 minutes. He basically tried all kinds of things to trick the system, including throwing a banana at it. His assistant took off his shoe and put it into the bin, and the robot just picked the shoe right up, which was a big relief to us. And we just had this fantastic experience. And he said, "This is a problem that we are really trying to solve, and you've gotten further than anyone we've seen." So that was a huge endorsement for us, and it was a huge thrill for the whole team. So that was the turning point. And, you know, the guys were driving back from that overnight and called me in the morning and said, "Let's do it."
Because I know they used to, again, not looking for you to say anything here, but I would just love to see other systems that they've tested. I know they used to run that picking challenge. I don't think they do the picking mm-hmm. challenge anymore. I think they ran it for, I don't know, 2 or 3 years, but that's a great story. Thanks for sharing that.
So guys, what's next for Ambi Robotics? You guys have taken an interesting path to get to this point. You're out of stealth now, so the world knows about you. What's the next step?
I can say from my side, and Ken, you can add, please. The next step for us is build and deploy and support these solutions that we have committed to our customer. And for the next set of customers that I talked about who are coming in the door. So for me, it is always about doing instead of just talking. So I think we're better well served if we just do things, and we will be doing a lot of those things right now. And then let's get through the next holiday, because I'm always thinking about the next holiday, and see where we go from there.
And thanks, Jim. I think you're hearing, which is why I have so much confidence in this team, because Jim really exemplifies this idea of under-promise and over-deliver. So really, that's been our motto. And so we're really careful not to make claims that we can't live up to. There are very important aspects of this, like how can the system improve over time? Because we have a lot of data. It's generating data every time it picks up a package. So that's a really exciting area at forefront for us to be expanding. The other is that we're developing new applications, new kinds of tooling, grippers, new sensors, new simulations, new algorithms for motion planning, which is very exciting to us. So there's a huge number of new research problems that kind of open up when you really start getting into the details. So I'm excited about it because it's spurring new research. And as Jim said, there's just a lot of new players coming into this sector. And we don't see it as winner take all, that one winner's got to dominate and everyone else is going to fail. We see that there's going to be many successful companies here. And we just want to be one of them.
Maybe one more final thought from you, Ken. I think you kicked off the conversation saying this is a problem that you've been working on for what, 35 years, you know, really a life's passion of yours. Just how exciting is it for you to be at this stage? How exciting is it to go, you know, see where this all goes? And if you can just sort of encapsulate how things have evolved in that 35 year timeframe to give us sort of a state of robotic grasping. And well, we only have 20 minutes, so I'll keep you quick.
Well, Steve, I will tell you, actually, I like that, because recently I realized that when I was a kid, I was incredibly clumsy. I was the kid who you'd throw any ball at me and I would drop it. So I was like the last kid that picked on any sports team, et cetera. So, you know, I think that's that intuitively, that's why I went into grasping to really address this personal shortcoming. And I'm still a bit clumsy, actually. But so there's a little bit of revenge of the nerds aspect here, because I was always that kid on the, you know, out of the on the, you know, at recess that nobody wanted on his team. On their team. And so now, you know, I'm able to actually have the system that can pick up things better than any of those kids could ever do it. So I feel like that is, you know, incredibly rewarding to see ideas that have been developed in the lab moved into real reality. I mean, I can't tell you how much a feeling of pride I have when knowing that as we're speaking, there's robots out there that are actually handling real packages. That just feels incredibly, you know, to see that in action. And I come from a family of engineers and entrepreneurs. And so, you know, the idea of getting things to really work, to really solve real problems for real customers, that is something that I find incredibly valuable.
Yeah, that's great. And I think things have turned out pretty okay for you. So don't worry about the sports stories you shared there. I think you're doing just fine. Well, hey, Ambi Robotics co-founder Ken Goldberg, CEO Jim Leifer, thank you, gentlemen, for fitting us in and joining us here on the podcast. Please keep us updated on any news, case studies that you can going forward. And, you know, Mike and I wish you nothing but the best of luck. So thanks again for joining us.
Yes. Thank you, guys.
Oh, thank you, guys. Really appreciate it. Really fun talking to you.
It's time now for the engineering tip of the week, brought to you by Futech Advanced Sensor Technology. Futech helps robotics innovators like NASA and the world's leading med tech companies shape the future by providing custom sensing and test measurement solutions for groundbreaking applications. In this week's tip, Futech's Vice President Naveed Mockberry gives you the scoop on what sensor to use to improve robotic performance.
If you're a loud and proud robotics nerd like us, you're probably always researching the latest thing that will improve robotic performance. And if you're an engineer, you're likely familiar with 6-degree of freedom sensors and how they help ensure high precision movement in robotic applications. But you may not know that there are alternative methods and, in fact, a better kind of torque sensor for optimizing robotic performance. Our strain wave gear torque sensor offers higher precision capabilities for closed loop feedback, but it's lighter, has higher temperature stability, more flexibility in geometry and design, and in most cases, lower power consumption. It's particularly well suited for applications like surgical robotics, since strain wave gearing offers higher reduction ratios in a single stage and very low backlash. The traditional crosstalk that's inherited by 6-degree of force solutions is substantially reduced, but besides capabilities, there are other advantages to the strain wave gear torque sensor. It has a much shorter learning curve, as it's a lot easier to implement. The fact that it has a single channel per joint means that there's a lot less room for error. It also means that there are no hidden costs, which makes it less expensive, both to install and to maintain, because it's also easier and less expensive to service. It can be customized with dual channels for redundancy and safety, and you can embed electronics with fault detection. And unlike 6-degree of freedom sensor, there's no need to replace it if a channel is malfunctioning. There are a lot more things to say about these sensors, but to summarize, the strain wave gear torque sensor blows your traditional 6-degree of freedom sensor out of the water because it performs better, saves you time, and saves you money. To learn more about Futech's proprietary strain wave gear torque sensor, go to futech.com.
Moving on here, Mike, I know you had a chance to sit down earlier this week with Carbon Robotics CEO and founder Paul Meixel. The Seattle-based company this week unveiled its third-generation autonomous weeding robot that drives through fields, can identify unwanted weeds, separate them from the crops or the plants, and individually destroy those unwanted plants. The machine uses robotics, artificial intelligence, and laser technology to do its job. Just what were your takeaways from the discussion, and what should we expect from this company going forward?
Well, Steve, we've seen a big uptick in ag tech automation solutions, you know, being released over this past year. And really, I think it seems that many of these robotic companies were moving from the initial prototype stage to production machines now, which I think is a sign that this technology is finally matured. So I think that's great news. And, you know, in the case of Carbon Robotics, as we'll hear in the upcoming interview here, they've matured the training of their machine vision models for plant identification, as you said. And, you know, that's required a huge set of tagged data to produce a model that could determine which plants are weeds and which are crops. Something, you know, as humans, it seems pretty obvious, but, you know, to train a machine vision model to do that takes a huge effort and a ton of data. And I think that seems to have been the biggest time investment for the company up to this point. And beyond that, I'll leave it for you to listen. But, you know, as he describes this machine, it's really fascinating for anybody that's, you know, a robot geek. And I think the most amazing thing is that, you know, they're using this huge laser to zap the weeds, not unlike Star Wars. It's definitely an interesting solution to the problem. And I think it's one that's going to be very useful for farmers going forward. So let's take a listen and hear what this a new application and solution is all about. Paul, welcome to the show. And can you take us through maybe the genesis of the company? How did you start the company, and how have you introduced this first product?
Yeah, you bet. Hello to you and all the folks listening. Yeah, great. So I have spent most of my career working in deep tech technology, focusing on computer vision, robotics, deep learning, AI, all of the stuff that allows computers to see and understand what's going on in the world. Mm-hmm. And after having spent couple of decades in tech and working with venture capital and early stage companies, having some notable successes and things like that, I really wanted to figure out how we could take all of this new technology that we had been developing and put it to work in something that had real world implications, that was actually doing hard labor work. And so agriculture, hugely important. It's one of the most important things that humans do. It's the basis for society. It's, you know, it's one of the oldest activities and most important activities. And so spent a lot of time working with farmers and trying to understand what areas were the most difficult, the most challenging that robotics could really help with. Mm-hmm. And spent a long time actually initially with Shay Myers out at Owyhee Farms out there in Idaho, on the Idaho-Oregon border. You may be familiar with them, or some of your viewers might be. And he had been doing a lot of projects around automation for the purposes of consistency of operations, consistency of information, getting labor out of the field in ways where, you know, the labor market was becoming challenging and difficult for them to get all the workers they wanted. And so we spent a lot of time, you know, working together and running through things. And so the most obvious target after a long time, you know, experimenting was weed control. Mm-hmm. Right? So weed control, one of the most important things, as any farmer knows, you know, if you don't weed your fields, you'll lose half of your crops and make the other half really difficult to harvest. So it's an important aspect. And how do we tackle this in a way where, if possible, reduce or remove the dependency on herbicides, mm-hmm. and go to a no-till or low-till solution for regenerative agriculture goals and soil health and, you know, proper water absorption and all of these things. And so after a lot of work and a lot of thinking and experimentation, we discover that we can actually do quality, highly accurate weed removal with a laser system. And so we have spent the last 2.5 years really focusing on building a solution that uses very high powered lasers to destroy these weeds with our computer software that uses AI to determine what's a weed and what's a crop.
I think it's a fascinating application. And really, when you talk about, you know, the computer science behind this, the machine vision that's behind this, and also the, you know, the use of AI now, I think that we as humans, we can look at a plant and say, well, that's obviously something that I want to nurture and that's something I want to kill. But how is it that you're able to differentiate between wanted and unwanted plants?
Yeah, that's a great, great question. So in the last 5 to 7 years in the AI space and more generally the computer vision space, there's been a revolution in the kinds of accuracy in computer vision that a computer can identify objects within images and determine what they are. Mm-hmm. And this technology you may be familiar with when you, for example, post things to Facebook, a picture, and it automatically suggests that, you know, this might be your cousin in the background, that kind of thing. It's the same kind of technology that can be controversial because they deployed in surveillance systems and things of that nature. Mm-hmm. We decided to take this technology and apply it to something that was that could help us with, as I mentioned, that some of this most important aspects of things that humans do, which is growing crops and then weed control. And I can, you know, I can talk all day about the technology, but briefly, it falls into the category of deep learning neural networks.
You train the system that this is what a corn plant looks like. And this is, so you have to train all the different types of of crops that you're interested in, as well as the unwanted plants. This is a weed.
Yeah, that's right. I'll talk about that a little bit. So the general concept of a neural net is that we use high power GPUs that were originally developed for graphics applications, but it turns out do a great job for the implementation of neural nets, which in some ways simulate a brain, but it's multiple overlapping or multiple layers of connections that we call neurons, just like in a brain. And but we're talking about millions of those connections. And you're absolutely right. We gather imagery, and then we have a labeling system, and we have partners who employ folks from around the world to help label these images for us. Mm-hmm. And then those labels we run back through the neural net and train it. And so what I mean by a label is example pictures where through our tooling is somebody has gone through and marked this is a weed and this is a crop. And we do have to differentiate by weed type and by crop type, mm-hmm. because we want to make sure we're protecting the crops. And the weeds are different weeds require different levels of energy to kill them and different targeting locations to kill them effectively. And so it is a data collection initial pass that we do. And then we train the neural net, and then we're good for weeding. Through the season, we will continually gather more images to fine tune that neural net, because the soil changes over time, the crops change over time, as do the weeds. Okay, so it is a process of continual training throughout. Every time we go, for example, to a new region or we do a new crop type, we have to gather a bunch of imagery, and we'll keep doing it through the season. Once we've been through a particular crop and a particular soil type for a full season, then the next year when we come around, there's a lot less of that training. Hmm. Yeah.
And is there a certain window of time of the plant's growth that the system is particularly optimized for, or does it work well in terms of the size of the plant and the size of the weeds?
Yeah, great, great question. We like to get in there very early when the weeds are just popping up, before they've had much root system development. Mm-hmm. It's the time where our lasers spend very little time shooting them. The energy delivery required to kill them when they're little tiny weeds, you know, even cotyledon stage weeds is optimal for us because we can kill them and keep moving.
Yeah.
And it also works well because the weeds have had very minimal chance to disturb the soil or absorb nutrients from the crops you're trying to grow. And then our process is we can keep weeding through the entire season. We can weed all the way up to harvest.
Oh, okay.
And because of the accuracy. So what you get is a situation where the crops are growing and it's only new weeds popping up because we've killed the old ones along the way. And then we just keep shooting them. So that's the idea. There are situations where if the weeds get too far along, it just takes too long for the lasers to shoot them. So we try to get in there relatively early and shoot the weeds when they're small.
Yeah, I can totally relate to that because this year in my yard, I decided to do away with Roundup and go to, I bought one of those propane torches.
Sure, it's
totally fun to go fry everything in the yard, but I have to go back multiple times because it seems like it burns it back just to the root and then they pop back up another week later. And so I'm back out there burning them again. It's getting to be a little bit of a chore to keep burning raising the ground with the fire. And so you say you've got this laser that you can target against the weeds and you essentially just fry them. And you say you can do this around a full size crop. I guess I have a hard time imagining that around something as big as a corn stalk, but maybe other ground related crops. I don't know, strawberries and broccoli and those type of plants that are smaller. Looking at your machine, it seems like it works better for some crops and not others.
Perfect. Yeah. We're targeting on the lower row crops, specialty crops. So things like onions, sweet potatoes, asparagus, broccoli, cauliflower, carrots, mints, and herbs, that kind of stuff. And you're absolutely right. So corn and wheat, they grow too high for us, and it's kind of a different environment anyway. Mm-hmm. So we haven't been focusing on corn and wheat. There's a potential for us to do some stuff in soybean, but we're right now really focused on those lower ground crops.
Hmm.
So anything that's a vegetable that you eat directly is usually where we're focusing on, where most of the corn and wheat is processed and turned into something else.
Hmm. Now looking at and I would encourage the viewers to go to your site and look at the machine. It's pretty big. So tell us what's under the hood. I'm just curious, how big is this laser? And tell us a little bit about the locomotion. Is it mechanical, electric drive? You mentioned something about powered by a Cummins diesel engine. Does it work like a train engine where it's all electric and you're just using the diesel to give you electricity? What's going on?
Great. So when I say laser, I want to make sure that you and your listeners get the right picture here. So this is an industrial size cutting laser. So it's the kind of thing you would use to cut metal.
Hmm.
It is 150 watts CO2 laser. The output wavelength of the laser itself is 10.6 microns, which is far outside the visible range or any kind of infrared range that these crops are used to seeing and that the weeds are used to seeing. So we destroy the weeds and they're not able to adapt or handle this. It's really outside their the range of wavelengths that they can absorb and deal with. So this is if you want to picture it, it's about 6.5 feet long. And the diameter of the tube is probably 5 or 6 inches. It's pretty big. So we have 8 of those on the machine. So
8.
Wow. Yeah, that's right. So picture them. They're aligned row wise. So they're aligned with the direction of travel as we're driving down the row, and they're stacked 8 across. And all of our targeting system is based on optics and control. We have some pretty interesting optical control systems that we've been filing some patents on and things like that. So if people want to see how those help get into the real details, you can look at the patents or as we meet with people, you know, we'll certainly show them how it works. But that's where kind of all the targeting and computer systems come in. And then, yes, the electric system. So we generate the electricity to power the computer system that's running that neural net we talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And to power the cameras and to power the lasers. And then the rest of the system is all hydraulic driven. So it's a diesel Cummins engine running a hydraulic system for locomotion and then a generator for power for the rest of the computer and control system.
So it's not battery powered. You're generating the power on board and it can run all day. Just keep refilling the diesel.
Yeah, that's right. It'll run all day and all night. And the only input to the machine is diesel. Some folks might be wondering, you know, did we look at using batteries and maybe solar cells, you know, photovoltaics and that kind of stuff? We did. We ran the math on that. And to do this with a solar cell to get enough energy to keep the machine running, it would take about an acre of solar. it doesn't really pan out. We do intend to continue research and development into getting to electric and doing something maybe eventually where it's you know, superchargers in the field kind of thing. But that's you know, years and years off.
Well, when you talk about how much energy those lasers are taking, I mean, we see a similar thing, for example, on the autonomous mobile robots that are doing UV disinfection with this last year in the pandemic. So those have become popular devices, but again, they're all powered by battery and, you know, the usage is limited by how much energy the lights are taking to turn them on and off. And here you've got machines taking way more power. So that totally makes sense as a reasonable solution. So
yeah. We need to get our run times need to be, you know, minimum 20 hours a day. And if we had to charge a battery, it would be
totally makes sense now. So what's the business model for Carbon? Are you guys selling these machines as capital equipment? Are you offering it as a robots as a service model to the farmers? How's that work?
Yeah, we are selling the robots. We have a lease to own plan where farmers can do a yearly payment plan towards an ownership.
Mm-hmm.
So we have both of those models. We've not been doing robots as a service. There's a couple of reasons. First thing is that most of the farmers are telling us they just want to own or lease the robots directly so that the efficiency they gain by utilizing these systems, that they can capture that efficiency instead of a service organization, you know, charging them a fee and then the service organization capturing that extra efficiency. So I totally understand that. Some of the other big reasons is that we are in many ways measured, the ROI for a farm is measuring our throughput, how many acres we're able to handle per robot. And if we were a service model where we were having to trailer and untrailer these robots and move them from field to field or farm to farm, it would kill our efficiency. It would kill our uptime because of the travel between places. And so what we found is it's just better to have those machines at the fields already where they're running, and you know, really work in partnership with the farmers to do total season weed management instead of some charge per application.
I think you may have already answered this part of my follow-up question. And I think with many farm implements, there's a season for weeding, there's a season for seeding, there's a season for tilling. But I think you've said you plan on this being used year round. So early season, it's taking the early small weeds, but then you continue to do maintenance, if you want to call it that, on the weeds throughout the acreage, throughout the rest of the growing season. Is that true?
Yeah, that's right. And as farmers do rotation, you know, we'll follow that rotation. So if it's the same land that they're planting different crops over the season, over the year, then we'll adapt to that. And if they want us to move, you know, if they want to move the robots to different fields at different times of the year, that's totally fine too.
So they can get usage out of this equipment year round, then not just for a certain part of the season, which helps the ROI.
Yeah, that's right. Although we work to have an ROI that is a net positive for the farmers, you know, even if they aren't able to get, you know, full yearly use out of it because of the way that they're planting a rotation or something like that. So even with one planting a year, we're able to do a positive ROI for these farmers.
Wow. So Paul, are the farmers able to completely manage the deployment of the system in terms of getting it out to their fields? How does the system manage itself actually in driving across the farm and getting out to the fields and running its way through the fields?
Yeah, great. So just like the neural net that I was talking about, the AI vision system that can tell weeds from crops, we can also tell furrows. And so we use a similar technique to locate the furrows in the field, and the robot can drive itself up and down the furrows without the need to GPS mark out where each of the individual rows are. And so the robot figures that out on its own just through a vision system. We do have to set up a field boundary so the robot knows where it's safe to drive around. And we've been assisting farmers with setting that up. It's a pretty simple process of marking out some of the edge points. But in terms of the rows and automatically driving, the robot does all of that stuff on its own.
So from season to season, or from crop rotation to crop rotation, you're saying the farmer doesn't have to reset exactly where to start a furrow. The system can come in and say, oh, I see a row of plants here. This is where I can put my wheels safely so I'm not crushing a row of crops.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Great. Well, that seems like a really smart system.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks.
So I think my next question sort of comes around to the idea. I mean, you and I are both technologists. We love robotics for robotics' sake and technology. But why did you implement this as an autonomous mobile robot rather than maybe as an implement that the farmer pulls behind the tractor, where it could maybe do a similar job, but it's not fully autonomous? How'd you work through that?
Yeah, you bet. A lot of it is so that we don't tie up the farm tractor time to pull this implement around, because we do like to get in there early and be in there consistently throughout the season as new stuff shows up. It's just much easier for us and for the farmer, for the growers, if we're not having to tie up tractor time and things like that. The other thing is that the machine itself tries to, or does, modulate its speed based on what it's seeing. So if there's a denser area, we may want to slow down. If there's areas with low weed pressure, we'll speed up. And so that feedback loop would be more difficult if there was a human driver involved, because we would have to send some kind of speed up and slow down message. And so really the machine knowing what it's seeing and adapting its velocity to that is one of the key ways in which we drive efficiency for these farmers.
So is this going to be the first of a roadmap of ag-related autonomous solutions, or are you going to just focus on weeding for the time being and build your market presence and grow from there in the future? What's on your long-term roadmap?
Yeah, there's a combination of future robots, but also what we're calling the farm data platform, which is an idea we've been working with for some farmers. It's something in the future, but the thought is that since we already have all of this imagery, along with our predictions about the crops and the weeds and the health, that over time we can help provide farmers with more real-time data and information about what's going on in their field and across disparate fields to give them information for things about which crops or which fields would be ready for harvest, and predictions about when we think things will be ready for harvest, and stand count, you know, things like that. Soil health, you know, nutrient deficiencies. And so with our cameras and the imagery, we can give them real-time data immediately. And then over time, as the AI systems learn more about the predictive nature of the data, we can give them predictions about what they're going to see at the end of the season based on what we're seeing early on. So a lot of this is in tandem with farmers about what information is most important to them. And then we're gathering that information from our imagery and making it available. This is very early. We're very early in that process, but that is an important part for farmers. And then, on the pure robotics side, there are many other things that we're working with folks to start looking at.
Well, it certainly seems that ag tech has evolved and grown quickly in the last 10 years. Farmers have always been about data that for their crops that they kept in their head, certainly. And now it seems there's a lot of options, including a lot of drone-based solutions that help farmers keep track of, you know, watering and feeding and now weeding across. And so it's clear that they're, this new generation of farmers is definitely interested in using data to make better decisions and improve their yields.
Yeah, definitely. And we found that farmers are some of the most innovative business folks that are out there. They have these inputs that they have to manage. They're trying to work with nature to figure out what's going to happen and how to make it better. And then they have a whole market side and market and marketing and all of the, you know, quality control. It's there's a lot that goes into it. And I've been really impressed with all the farmers I've been working with.
Yeah, I've got some farmers in my family. And if there's one thing about, you can think of them as Luddites in one regard, but not really. They're cutting edge. They learn how to fix all of their equipment, but they also love to one up their neighbor too. So.
Yeah, sure. Right. That's right. Great to work with, you know, not a lot of tolerance for BS, you know, so if you can show up and show a real value, then that's great. And I really appreciate that from folks we've been working with.
Well, Paul, this has been a fascinating conversation. I want to thank you for giving us an introduction to Carbon Robotics. I wish you guys all the best with your product introduction here. And I'd love to have you come back again in 6 months and give us an update as to where you are. So thanks for joining us.
Great. Yeah, thank you very much. We'll continue to put videos up on the website as we gather more cool shots throughout these upcoming seasons. And thanks for having me.
You bet.
Mike, before we sign off here, we always like to give an update on what's going on. The latest with the Mars 2020 missions, somewhat of a setback this week, especially for the Ingenuity helicopter. Didn't end up interrupting the Masters for me. The golf tournament was quite boring, actually, most of the time. But they've delayed the initial launch of the Ingenuity helicopter after a high-speed rotor spinning test didn't go as planned. NASA initially delayed the first flight attempt until April 14th. However, while it was trying to fix the problem or diagnose how to fix the problem, it really determined that a software update to the flight controls was the only path forward for the Ingenuity helicopter. So they're working on that now. They're hoping to hit certain milestones and provide information about when the first flight date will actually happen. So that's hopefully coming next week. But I don't know how you feel about all this, Mike, but everything went so smooth, not only for the rover, but also for the Ingenuity helicopter to start off. getting a little nervous here. I'm getting a little nervous as to how this initial flight's actually going to go. How are you feeling about it?
Well, you know, I'm betting that Ingenuity is going to get off the ground okay, but as any good gymnast knows, it's about sticking the landing. And so, you know, I think it's going to be fun to watch either way. But I think the team's going to be as nervous as everyone else is when they can they actually get the this thing back down on the ground safely and then evaluate, you know, what happened and be able to attempt to do it again. Another update. Get back in the air again and actually fly around. So, you know, this is fun to watch. I'm an RC pilot, have been for many years. And
I love, I don't think I knew that.
So I love flight, but again, this is the ultimate.
a little different than what you do.
Yeah, but it's fun. So, you know, looking forward to this. It's going to be fun to watch the next week.
Yeah. So we'll keep an eye out on the latest, on the Mars 2020 mission and what's going on with the Ingenuity helicopter. Again, we've been covering it the whole time on the robotreport.com. So make sure you check it out next week. And I know I've plugged this a couple of times. We are in communication with those guys, you know, over the last couple of months, trying to lock them down to get them onto the podcast. We haven't reached out recently, especially with this little setback here, trying to let them focus on what they really need to be focusing on. But we hope to get them on the podcast in the coming weeks. So
that'll be fun. Look forward to that.
Yeah, we'll get them. I know you know some folks over there as well. So give us some time, folks. We'll have them on at some point to sort of discuss and break down what some of the challenges have been and really what some of the groundbreaking discoveries are all about that they're on the verge of making and already have made. So we'll get them on at some point soon. But hey, man, congrats again. I want to thank you for coming aboard. You're only going to help us grow and continue to grow our robotics portfolio here. And I know Mobile Robot Guy, it's going to be a huge growth catalyst for you. So excited to finally let the world know what's been going on here for the last, what's it been, a month or so?
Yeah.
two months. So I'm sure it's a huge relief for you. So let's get going, baby.
Thanks.
And that's going to do it, folks, for episode 41 of the Robot Report podcast. Thanks again to Ken Goldberg, Jim Leifer, and Paul Meixel for joining the program today. New episodes of the podcast drop each week. You can find us on Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, SoundCloud, Spotify, anywhere you get your podcasts. If you haven't already done so, please subscribe, leave us a rating, tell your friends, give us a review. And don't forget to check out our Robo Business Direct series, which continues April 29th. We'll be examining 5G in robotics. Attendees will be provided with a 5G capabilities review for robotic systems developers, as well as a snapshot of the existing state of 5G and current and potential uses of the technology. Again, all kicks off at 2 p.m. Eastern on April 29th. To register and check out the full Robo Business Direct schedule, visit robobusinessdirect.com. On behalf of Mike Oitzman and the entire Robot Report team, I'm Steve Crow. Take care, everyone. We'll talk to you again next week.